Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Humans found reasons to migrate over a land bridge some 25,000 years ago in the Pleistocene. I myself moved 10 times by the time I was 13, but never very far. Del Mar, LA, Hollywood, Alhambra, Pasadena, South Pasadena. We weren't forced to move. We weren't looking for a better climate or richer soil. We weren't the Jodes fleeing the Dust Bowl. We just moved around a lot. Families do that, maybe not as frequently or for the same reasons as my own, but they do move, emigrate, and resettle for a whole host of reasons. Family history, of course, is shaped both by the actions and decisions of individual family members and the cultural, political, and economic conditions of the time. And we're all, to a greater or lesser degree, whether we like it or not, a result of this history of decisions made by individual family members over the course of generations. How did we get here? Where did we come from? Why did we leave? And what did we give up in the process? These aren't just historical or genealogical questions, but existential ones. The answers say just as much about who our ancestors were as who we are. Meenal Hajratwala, the child of Indian immigrants born in San Francisco, raised in New Zealand and suburban Michigan, traces her family's movements from India to far-flung corners of the globe in her new book, Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. Meenal Hajratwala is a writer, performer, poet, and queer activist based in San Francisco. She spent 7 years researching and writing her new book, traveling the world to interview more than 75 members of her extended family. Her creative work has appeared in numerous journals, anthologies, and theater spaces, and has received recognition and support from the Sundance Institute, the Hedgebrook Writing Retreat for Women, the John Sims Center for the Arts, and the Serpent Source Foundation. Her one-woman show, Avatars, Gods for a New Millennium, was commissioned by the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco in 1999. She was an editor and reporter for 8 years at the San Jose Mercury News and was a National Arts Journalism Program Fellow at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She is a graduate of Stanford University. And the conversation this evening with Meenal is Swati Pandey. Swati is online editor at zocalopublicsquare.org, where she reviews books, interviews interesting people, and writes about Zocalo events. Zocalo, in case you didn't know, sometimes happens in this same space and is a wonderful program, does events all over LA from the Hammer Museum to the Skirball. Great program. Swati has also been a writer for the Los Angeles Times, Business, Calendar, Books, and Opinion Pages. Tonight's program will conclude with an audience Q&A. We ask that you wait for the microphone to get around to you before you ask your question because we want to hear it and we want to record it for podcast. You may be, you know, immortalized on the LA Public Library website if you ask a question tonight. You're all invited to join us after the program in the lobby for a book signing with tonight's author, books on sale courtesy of the library store, with proceeds going to support the Los Angeles Public Library. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in turning off all your noisemakers, cell phones, and pagers, and in welcoming Meenal Hajratwala and Swati Pandey to the Los Angeles Public Library.
This is the funnest part, is I get to move the podium up and down. How's the sound? It's okay? Good. It's so nice to be here in LA. I flew down yesterday, and I thought that we would start with a short reading from the middle of the book, and then Swati and I will talk for a little while, and then I think you'll have a chance to talk to me too. I started this book more than 7 years ago, and the middle part of the book is a chapter about my parents. And so this section that I'm going to read to start with is a meeting. It's kind of like a business meeting between my grandmothers, and they're arranging my parents' wedding. And my mother's mother's name is Benkor, which you'll hear, and my father's mother's name is Kashi. And this meeting takes place in the Fiji Islands, which is where both of my parents' families were living at the time. I try to envision my grandmother's meeting in the house on Foster Street in Suva, halfway up the hill, between the town and the hospital, with a view of the hot blue sea. By the time I first saw this house where my mother had grown up, it was a dilapidated version of its former self, covered in a coat of bright turquoise paint that was peeling into the humid air. On a long veranda, two women were rolling out papadums and setting them to dry in the sun. Now the house has been torn down. The large plot is a scrabble of dirt and weeds. An antique tamarind tree is the only familiar sight, the one my mother climbed as a girl decades ago. Back then, did my grandmothers have a view of the tamarind tree through a window as they talked? Did they sit on a sofa or at the kitchen table? Did one serve the other biscuits and tea? What niceties were exchanged before they got down to business? Who held the power, the trump card? What were their expectations of success or failure? My mother's mother would have worn the white cotton sari befitting a widow. My father's mother, wealthier and still married, might have worn something finer, but respecting her peer's status, not flashy. Benkor listened to Kashi's proposal. Like everyone else in town, Benkor knew Kashi and her quarrelsome reputation, knew also that Kashi's youngest son and his bride would, by community custom, be the ones charged with taking care of her, living under her roof as long as she lived. Could she sentence her last daughter, educated and vivacious, to such a fate? When Kashi had finished speaking, perhaps Benkor tilted her head, put a finger to her chin. After a moment, she spoke in her slow, succinct manner. Nallo tonei sako, she said, panmoto sako. With the youngest son, it's not possible. But with the older, possible. Possible, impossible. Plausible, impossible. Perhaps any child telling her parents' story must be a secret narcissist, entranced by the chance drama of her parents' meeting, the improbable string of twinkling lights that lead somehow to the explosion that is her own body. Though my parents' arranged marriage had more in common with a business deal than a love story, for me the tale carries all the intrigue of a passionate romance, and one with a most desirable outcome. When my grandmothers parted that afternoon, did either of them perceive with certainty the pattern of the future? When they gestured and negotiated toward a match, did they envision the grandchildren who would ensue from such a union? Did they predict, or even love, a decade in advance, me, the possibility of me? Thank you.
Thank you, that was fantastic. I love that passage especially because of what it says about a child choosing to write about their parents must be a secret narcissist. So tell us what else besides the narcissism led you to write this book.
So the book is each chapter is about one person in my family and his or her moment of migration. And I wanted to look at both kind of the personal stories, which are the ones that we hear in our families, I think, a lot of the time, which are things like, well, your great-grandfather, he wanted to go to Fiji, so he went. And then put that together with sort of the bigger picture of history and the social and economic forces in the world and figure out why were certain places open and closed to them at certain times, what would make somebody pick up and leave their home and go across two oceans and take a boat trip that took 3 months to settle in a foreign country. And so I felt like there was always a more complicated and deeper answer than what I could understand from just sort of the family stories. And I was really curious about that. When I was growing up, it was really normal for us to have visitors from Fiji or South Africa or England and, you know, go to travel and see our aunts in Toronto and Australia. And I didn't really think anything of it until I got older and sort of realized, oh, that's actually not how everybody's family is. And so then I guess I wanted to know, why was that the case? I have 36 first cousins, and they're all around the world in 9 different countries. And it's just striking to me that I didn't really grow up close to any of them, and I wanted to know why that was.
And writing about family, I've done it only once, and it was petrifying. Were you ever worried about revealing too much or what they would say?
I was worried about different things. I mean, yeah, it took me 7 years to write this book, and a fair amount of that time was actually grappling with the writing part. And some of the writing part involved fear of 2 things. One was fear of kind of overexposing or exploiting my family, and then the other was fear of being too shut off and not really giving the reader enough to make a compelling story. And then there was also sort of the fear of, you know, why is this even interesting? It's my family, but who else will care? So, yeah, a lot of that came up. And, you know, in the end, I took certain precautions, and I felt really comfortable with how I had been open with my family about what I was doing. So I was really pretty formal, actually, in my interviews. And I tried to explain to people what it meant to be on the record and off the record. And, you know, and I told them, because that's my training as a journalist, and I knew that most of them were probably not people who had really been interviewed before. So I wanted to make sure that they knew that, you know, that everything that they were telling me was actually for the public. And I asked them to let me know if we started talking about anything that they wanted to keep to themselves. And many people did, you know, avail themselves of that and ask me to turn off the tape recorder or keep out certain parts of their stories. And so I felt like, and then in the end, when I had a draft manuscript, I also shared it with the people who were main characters so that they could see their own story and have a chance to correct things that were factually inaccurate. So I feel good about kind of the process that I went through with my family.
Mm-hmm. And I know you have a background as a journalist and also as a performer, and your book seems to reflect that. It's very fact-based, but there are a lot of poetic, lyrical passages. Was that a difficult balance for you to strike as a writer? Was that sort of territory you were trying to carve out in a genre memoir that is often fictionalized or outright fiction in some cases?
Yeah. Definitely, it was a big part of the writing process was figuring out how to take these kind of 2 different voices and almost 2 different selves that I had been developing in parallel over a period of years and bring them together. And I did at times feel like they were fighting with each other, that, you know, the journalist part of me would get really immersed in the details and the research and get really excited about some obscure thing, and then the storytelling part of me would try to pull it in a different direction. And in the end, they did start to work together, and I felt really happy about that. And I felt like that's sort of the reason that this voice developed for the book, that it couldn't really just have been one or the other, because I wanted to tell both the really intimate personal parts of our experiences as immigrants and children of immigrants, and also to look at why that happens in the world. And that is not actually an artificial kind of combining of things. It's more, I came to think of it as kind of a work of restoration, as looking at what happened in these moments for real, you know, and developing a voice that made that possible. And actually, I think it might have been Louise, who runs the series, who at some point during the writing said to me that the important thing is to develop a form in which you can say anything that you want to say. And I feel like ultimately the book did become that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned different parts of your identity fighting against each other. And I know in the book you discuss how through the writing process you came to think of yourself as a migrant, as an immigrant. How did that impact the writing of the book and your conception of yourself as fitting into the Indian diaspora?
Mm-hmm. So I was born in San Francisco and I live in San Francisco now. And so I guess because of that, I sort of didn't really realize that I had had a migration experience. But when I was 6 months old, we moved from San Francisco to New Zealand. And then when I was 7 years old, we moved back to the United States to suburban Michigan. And so I definitely had that experience of coming into this country as a child into a new town, a new school system, a whole new kind of society and different pop culture references, different racial stratifications. So I don't think that I realized until I started writing that I really did have the same kind of migration trauma that anyone would have as a child coming in at that age to a new country. And then when I was in college, I had what I now think of as another kind of migration experience, which is that I came out. And for me, becoming a lesbian seemed like another kind of migration from the familiar world that I grew up in, of my family and my community, to kind of this new world that was at once more cosmopolitan in a certain way, but also had its own codes and norms and just new situations to read and learn about. And so there is a kind of, there has been a period in my life where it felt like I was sort of moving constantly between these two very different worlds. And now, partly through the process of writing the book and also partly through a process of just growing up, I think, I don't feel so much of that segregation. I feel more of an integration. And I feel that the situations where all of my worlds and all of my communities are integrated and can be in the same room, in the same space, are more frequent in my life, which helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. There's a great line from the book that I have here. You mentioned that it is hard to remember the America where I grew up. So is part of the reason that you've started to feel more at home now with your identity is that the country has changed? And if so, how has it done that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I remember being a kid in very white suburban Michigan, and, you know, one of our teachers in high school, a white teacher, introduced just once, like half an hour of yoga, just as like kind of a, you know, this is one of the things that exists in the world, have an experience. And it was kind of a big deal. Like the Christian right in the town really thought that that was really bad. And it was
yoga,
like religion in the public school. And you know, now there's a yoga studio on every other block and in people's gyms, 24-hour fitness, whatever. So it is a different America, and it's a less insulated America. I also remember that when we said, I remember being in second grade, and when we said we were Indian, people said, "What tribe?" So they just really didn't know anything about India. And, you know, now the world is very different, and part of that is the phenomenal growth of the South Asian community here too, which at that time was about 400,000 people spread all across the U.S., and today is something like 1.7 million as of the 2000 census. So it's, what, three times? And I think that in terms of influence and visibility, it's even more dramatic, the change over that time.
Mm-hmm. How has the Indian community here changed? I mean, besides the growth, is there a different relationship with other immigrant communities or with the country itself?
The community itself has changed pretty significantly. There, at that time, there were sort of two very discrete groups of South Asians in the United States. One was people who had come prior to prior to 1900, actually, and were mostly in Northern California and Washington and Oregon, and were the descendants of those very early immigrants who came to work on the railroads and also farms. And so those communities were quite small and didn't really penetrate the rest of the U.S. And then in 1965, and then after that, the U.S. cut off Asian immigration. So from 1917 to 1965, there was almost no Asian immigration to the U.S. It was, from India, it was 100 people a year. And in 1965, Lyndon Johnson signed the Immigration Act, which totally overturned our immigration policy. And so from that point on, there were 10,000 immigrants from India per year that were allowed, and all the countries were on an equal basis. So that was the end of sort of the Asian exclusion period. But beginning in 1965, with that policy, most of those immigrants were admitted on the basis of their professional qualifications. So there were sort of three main ways that you could get to the U.S. One was if you were highly skilled, and you had skills that were considered to be needed in the U.S., which was like engineers, doctors, scientists, physical therapists, which my mother was one. And then a second was for education, you could come in. And then a third was if you had a close relative, so a spouse or a parent or a child or a sibling. So in that early period from about 65 to 1980 or so, most of the immigrants from India and from China came in those professional and educated categories. After that, that early group had citizenship, and so they began bringing in their relatives who didn't necessarily have the same level of education. And so the economic class profile of the Indian community is quite different now. So when I was growing up, it was mostly a fairly professional, suburban, like easily integrated economically community. And now you see a lot more working class South Asians, and you also see a lot more communities that are clustered together. So like Artesia here in Southern California, and there's Little Indias are kind of popping up in different areas across the U.S., and that's a more recent phenomenon, probably in the last 20 years or so.
How is immigration policy today changing the community? I know a lot of the visas are still based on skills, but sometimes it's harder to get the green card. You know, once you get the H-1B visa, you can't actually stay. So how is that pattern changing the diaspora? Are more people going back?
It seems like there is, a trend of people going back. A friend of mine who's a journalist named Sandeep Roy just did a four-month fellowship and wrote a series of articles and produced some radio pieces about that phenomenon of re-migration of either immigrants from India or even the children of immigrants from India who have decided to go to India and that the economic prospects are actually better for them and they want to raise their children there, at least for a period of time. So that's definitely happening, and that's also a response to the economy that we have here now, that people are just feeling like, why not go somewhere where the economy is still growing? And I think the thing that most recently changed the migration profile for South Asians, two things. One is 9/11, which really led to a tightening of a lot of the immigration categories and some of the ways that people had been coming were just suddenly much harder to get. So at one point, it was much easier to get a student visa, for example, from India if you had a university here that you had admissions to. Now for a young single male in India to get a student visa is really quite hard. Same with Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, any of the South Asian countries. There is a restriction that's being applied in that way. And then the other thing that happened in 2001 was that the internet economy kind of collapsed, and so the number of people coming on these temporary visas, the H-1B visas, as computer workers also dropped off pretty significantly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that before that, the people who were on those visas who wanted to stay generally were able to stay because they could find an employer to sponsor them. With our economy in the U.S. the way it is now, it's, I think, getting much harder. It's because in order to hire someone who's on a temporary work visa, you have to prove that you, as an employer, you have to prove that you could not fill that job with any American citizen. And in this economy, I think that's becoming very hard to prove.
Do you think the diaspora has a strong identity? The people you discuss in your book are, of course, united by family, but they too have many different motives for leaving their countries. What holds us all together?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think the diaspora is very, very diverse. You know, this book goes from South Africa to Hong Kong to Australia, New Zealand, England, Canada, the U.S., Fiji, and India. And of course, so by definition, really, the thing that holds us together is India. But what that means to each person and each community, I think, varies really widely. So for some of us, it's really just the way we look, and we don't really necessarily have that much of a connection. For others, it's that plus maybe a little bit of cultural connection or the food or our families or a little bit of the language. And then for other people, it's very important. It's everything from the way that they eat, dress, marry, you know, raise their children, pray. Everything is determined by that place of origin and their, at least, perception of how things were done back home, that there's a very strong impulse to kind of hold on. But I do think that for most people in the diaspora, there is, especially the first and second generations out, there is this process of choosing, and my parents call it kind of choosing the best of both worlds. And I think that most of us are doing that in some way or another, even if we might disagree about how much to hold on to and how much to let go of. So, you know, for example, there are people in my family who are very concerned with things like arranging marriages and making sure that certain traditions are preserved. But at the same time, they might wear blue jeans. So they're still making some choices and changing some of it up. And then at the same time, India itself is also changing and reinventing itself all the time. And there's as much that's modern and like postmodern in happening in India as there is in the diaspora, if not sometimes more so. I think sometimes those of us who have left a place are kind of ossified in that moment of leaving. So, you know, maybe if somebody left their village in 1940, they remember how things were in the village in 1940. But if they went back now, they might not recognize it.
Right.
And I think that process of going back and not finding the home that you left is also a common experience of diaspora.
Mm-hmm. How has how you see India and the choices you make, how has that changed from, say, your childhood to through the process of writing the book to now?
I think for me, growing up, you know, so sort of isolated, I went through a period as a child where I rejected a lot that was Indian because I was really just trying to survive and fit in my school, in my seventh grade on the school bus. and I really, you know, there's a certain age where fitting in, where in this country in particular, the way that we sort of define adolescence here, fitting in with one's peers is really important, and rebellion against one's parents is almost sort of considered to be a natural part of adolescence in America. That period for me eventually did pass. and I think there's something that happened in the process of writing the book and just talking to so many people in my family. I interviewed between 75 and 100 people in my family to write the book, and hearing everyone's stories and just hearing how much we all really had in common and how much we could connect if we could get to that level of deeper conversation, even if somebody grew up in Fiji and somebody grew up in Hong Kong, and we didn't even necessarily have much of a common language, but there was always some piece of somebody's story that, you know, that I really felt in my heart and that that seemed to me to illuminate something about the condition of being in diaspora for me as well, and for, and in a way, I think for a lot of us in living in this time where people move a lot, you know, there's something kind of primal about this experience of being uprooted and set down somewhere new that is just a part of like the human response to that situation that comes out in these amazing little anecdotes and stories mm-hmm. that people told me.
How do you think your family has changed going through this process, both doing interviews with you and now reading this book now that it's come out? Mm-hmm. Has it changed how everyone interacts with everyone else or even how often you see each other or how close you feel to each other?
I don't know that my family has really changed. I mean, it's also the book just, the official release date was March 18th, so many of them have not even seen the book, and those who have seen it have just seen it and haven't necessarily read it. For the interviewing, I think for some people was really great. I had one cousin tell me after a 2-hour interview, she was like, "Wow, that was great. That was like therapy." And for the older people in my family, I think they really enjoyed just having a younger person who was willing to sort of sit and listen to their stories and things that they, you know, were always trying to tell their children and grandchildren and were always sort of being put off about. They were happy to talk. So I think there was just something in that kind of human act of being listened to that was helpful for some people. But I don't know that the book is really having a big ripple effect on the family, at least not yet. Okay. We'll see what happens when they read it.
Has the torch been passed on to you, at least, about being the, sort of the family storyteller? There's an uncle in there that you mentioned that takes great pleasure in telling his stories. Is that you now?
My family is full of storytellers, so I think I get to be one of them now. I don't think I'm the storyteller by any means.
Very good. Some of the stories, you focus a lot on the women in your family, and you discuss in the book how the family trees that your family keeps, for example, don't necessarily have women's names on them. Did you feel a particular obligation to tell their stories or at least, you know, perform that storytelling function for the women in your family?
I don't know that I saw it as an obligation, but I was just very interested. For me, some of the most dynamic and amazing people in my families have been the women. My great-grandmother who lived in India, and we called her Maji, which means respected mother, and she was just this very sort of strong, powerful woman who had control over several generations of her family until she died. And I never met her, and, you know, I just wanted to know about her life, and I was interested. But at the same time, I don't think that there was a... I definitely feel like there's a way that this is a feminist project in that it takes on this idea that the personal is political and really implements that. And so as someone who, you know, had a couple of really influential classes from a feminist historian in which that idea was present in my training, there is that. But I don't feel like it was a feminist project in the sense of setting out to tell the sort of overlooked women's stories or anything like that. If that was present because it was driven by my own curiosity as an artist and as a as someone looking to tell the whole picture. And there is a different side of things that I think is illuminated in the day-to-day life that women have.
Was there anything particularly surprising you learned during your interviews and your research about your family or about the diaspora?
Yeah, when I was in South Africa, I was in Durban, and I was staying with one of my father's cousins, and there's a large Indian community in Durban because it's kind of in South Africa under apartheid, it was a place where Indians were forced to settle, actually. So they weren't actually allowed to migrate out of Durban for a period of decades. And so this community was very large and very close. And so I wanted to just learn more about the community. And I went into the local history museum of Durban, and I thought, oh, maybe there'll be some information on the Indian community of Durban. And I walked into one of the rooms, and I was looking at the Indian materials, and then I saw on the wall a photograph of my uncle, who I was staying with. And I was like, huh. And then it turned out there was actually this whole display about his family, because starting with his grandfather, they had been kind of an important restaurant-owning family. And that restaurant was actually a place where people gathered to meet and plan resistance against the apartheid government. So that was a great surprise. And, of course, I went back and asked him all kinds of questions about his grandfather, and his grandfather actually became the main character of Chapter 3 in the book, which is called Bread, and which is kind of about this act of trying to sort of earn one's daily bread in a society where everything is set up for you not to do that.
And is he the one who invented yes. that sort of staple food?
The bunny chow. Yes. So the bunny, has anyone heard of or eaten a bunny chow? Okay, so the bunny chow is sort of now considered one of the national dishes of South Africa, and what it is basically a loaf of bread with curry stuffed inside it. And it can be any kind of curry, and it's a so whole good. Loaf. And I actually was just, I just came from New York, and I was in Brooklyn, where there is a South African restaurant, and I had a bunny chow. And so if you ever have a chance to go and eat a bunny chow, you should not eat anything else that day before or after. Just keep in mind you're eating a whole loaf of bread. But it's a delicious food. But the story of the bunny chow is that it was invented in this area of Durban because a law was passed that Africans were no longer allowed to eat in restaurants. So they were not allowed to sit down and eat in restaurants. And many of them by that time were eating Indian food and were coming to the Indian restaurants. And so this in this community, the Indian restaurant owners came up with this idea of, this was like in the 1940s most likely, so before styrofoam and all that kind of stuff. So they had this idea of giving takeaway by putting it in the bread loaf, and that was the container. And so that was sort of something that came up spontaneously in this area. But my great uncle is credited with inventing the vegetarian version of that, which is called the beans bunny, because he was a strict vegetarian for his life.
Very good. The chapter that follows that, speaking of sort of resistance and your family's involvement, focuses on, I believe, your maternal grandfather who marched with Gandhi during the salt tax protest. You've said that that's where you started writing. Why was that your entry point?
Yeah, before I started working on this book, and probably even before I became a journalist, I was writing poetry, and I've always written poetry, and I still do. And I had tried to tell some of the stories in my family that moved me in the form of poems. So that was an early poem that I wrote that was about this photograph of my grandfather, whose name was Narottam. And the photograph is of him. He's wearing white, and he's just come out of jail from serving 3 months of hard labor in jail. And he was sentenced to that because he took part in Gandhi's salt march, which in 1930 was a protest against this salt tax. But symbolically, it was a protest against British rule in India. And thousands of peasants joined on this march toward the sea. And so they started in one of the cities, and then they marched, I think it was 30 or 40 days
to the sea and they made salt from the beach. They just sort of like picked it up from the salt beds, and that was illegal under the British because you were only supposed to buy salt from government-endorsed manufacturing plants, which levied this tax. And so my grandfather was not, you know, an important leader or anything. He was just one of the ordinary people who were swept up in the importance of this historical moment. And I was excited to learn of his story, which I hadn't known as a child. And so I had written this poem about him, but I found, I think, that with the stories of my family, that there wasn't room in the kinds of poems that I was writing for the epic scope of the stories, and so they just were never very satisfying as poems. But from that poem, I wrote an initial passage that then expanded into a chapter about him. And that moment of resistance and activism in his life is actually what caused his migration, because his father, when he came out of jail, decided that his son was becoming a radical and it was very inappropriate. And so he decided to send him to Fiji to work in the family business. And so that was how he was, how he became a migrant.
The way you enter that story in the book, I especially like. It's you're watching the film Gandhi with your mom, I believe, when you were 11.
Yes.
Is that right? I'm curious how much of your family history you knew as a child, and whether a lot of it came out sort of in surprising bits and pieces like that.
Yeah, it did come out in surprising bits and pieces, and you know, I think I was a pretty normal child in the sense that I wasn't so interested in history, and I probably wouldn't have really cared if. You know, if someone sort of started sitting me down and talking to me about how important my family was and how I should know my ancestors, I probably would have been like, yeah, can I go play tag now? but there was, so in the movie Gandhi, there's this scene of the salt march, and you see the marchers and they're, you know, walking toward this salt bed and the British police are beating them down with sticks. And eventually with horses, and you know, it's a really moving scene, and I remember that it happened right before the intermission where we saw it, and then during the intermission I was really caught up in it, and I was crying, and my mother was like, oh, you're crying, and then she told me that her father had been in that march, and that was how I learned about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So when did you decide was there a moment when you realized you were interested in the history and when all of this started to come together?
Yeah, I am. So in 2001, in January, I was on a fellowship at Columbia University, and there was a class in the Graduate School of Journalism that I took on writing a nonfiction book proposal, and I sort of thought, oh, I'd like to... learn how to write a book proposal. And in order to get into the class, you had to have a book idea. And so somehow in the process of just talking to several of my peers about what I could write a book about, this is what emerged. And there was, especially at that moment, the whole memoir trend was very hot. And people were encouraging me actually to write a memoir. And I was resisting because I really felt like, you know, I was 29 or 30, and I just didn't really feel like there was anything particularly startling or interesting about my life. But as I talked to people, it seemed like my family's life was very interesting. And that got me to thinking about kind of the deeper levels of what I was interested in. And initially, I actually thought that I would not put myself in the book at all, that I would approach it from a very journalistic place, and in the process of writing the book proposal and working with my professor, who actually was very kind of hardcore journalism guy, who didn't really like the memoir trend at all, but he felt like it would be ridiculous to try to tell this story without putting myself in it, and ultimately that really made sense to me, although it was a bit of a struggle. But in terms of just finding the writing voice, I was very comfortable with kind of the objective journalism voice and finding the more intimate voice that ultimately I think this book really benefits from, because it gives it a lot of layers. But finding that voice took some time, and also telling my own story felt like it just was necessary from the point of view of having integrity. You know, I was asking my family members to really disclose a lot, and they really gave me very, very personal stories and told a lot of their lives and shared a lot. And after I did my interviewing and my research, I traveled around the country, around the world actually, for about a year interviewing people. And then when I got home, the first chapter that I wrote was about myself, because I realized that I had all of this very, very personal material from other people, and I needed to have a sense of how naked and vulnerable I was willing to be about my own life. And then that was kind of the only way that I could approach other people's stories.
Mm-hmm. How challenging was that? You do reveal a lot of pretty intense stories in the chapters you do spend on yourself. Mm-hmm. Was that did you have to push yourself to go that far with it?
I think where I had to push myself was to understand and make sense of my childhood. You know, I feel like I made a lot of progress, and I don't know, just personally, like, coming to terms with what happened to me as a child, the racism that happened to me, kind of uncovering some of those stories which I didn't even remember, which my parents knew, that kind of thing, that was definitely emotional work. And there was an intensity about it, but I didn't really have hesitation about revealing it. Mm-hmm. And then the second, so there's one chapter about me where I talk about first my migration experience as a child, and then my migration experience coming out as a lesbian. And in both of those parts, there was definitely some choice as to sort of how much to say in terms of quantity, just because it's not a book about me. and there, it was possible. And for all of the chapters, really, I probably wrote a book about, you know, three times this size, and then edited down. And I think that editing process was important for kind of coming to the core of the stories.
Mm-hmm. And I have to,
not for hiding things.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I have to ask this. I think anybody who's been bullied kind of wants to sort of write about the bullying and be the hero of the story. Did you feel any satisfaction about writing it all down? Did it feel, not just that, but just in general, did it feel like a catharsis?
I did feel some catharsis and some satisfaction. But, you know, I don't... Actually, I've been doing readings now for a few weeks in different places, and I don't really read those parts. Mm-hmm. I don't find satisfaction in going back to that time in my life, actually. Okay. And even when I flip through the book, I kind of avoid those parts.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you're doing now and whether you feel at home where you are. There's a concept you introduce in the book about cumulative inertia and how people who move tend to keep on moving. Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself one of those people who's going to keep on moving, whether from place to place, from, you know, type of writing to type of writing? Or do you feel at home now where you are?
I feel more at home now where I am than I ever have. I live in San Francisco. I live about 10 blocks from where my parents lived when I was born. There's something very satisfying about that. And I live in a really diverse, amazing community that feels like home to me. And, you know, there's, from time to time, there's some restlessness, but actually, I hate moving.
Very good. I think we have time for some questions, unless you wanted to do another. Did you want to read?
Maybe I'll read a short section.
There's an LA portion that we were.
So this part is about, it takes place in Los Angeles, actually. And it's about my cousin Mala, who's here today. So thank you for being here. And Mala is actually one of the heroes of the book to me. She, it's odd to talk about her with her in the room, but she came to the U.S. on a lottery visa. So most people, most Americans don't know that our government every year gives out 50,000 green cards by lottery. So Mala was a lucky winner, and she came from Fiji with her family. And this part is just about her mourning. Yeah, her mournings. Her chapter is called Shelter. When Mala's alarm clock buzzes at 5:20 a.m., or sometimes in the silence a minute or two before, she leaves her sleeping husband and climbs out of bed. She is nearly 50 years old. Her limbs are heavy, and sometimes her lower back or legs ache. But her will is strong. If it's summer, the Los Angeles sky is already light and hazy. If winter, it is dark, and sometimes stars peek through the smog. After her ablutions, she sets the cha on the stove. Milk, water, black tea, sugar, and her own family's blend of spices, an authentic ancestor of the chai sold in trendy cafes throughout the City of Angels. Keeping one eye on the tea, which is prone to boiling over the sides of its pot the second she steps away, she stirs together a quick breakfast, perhaps some eggs and or toast and or shiro, a hot semolina cereal with ghee and sugar. A big morning meal is necessary to fortify her still sleeping family. Madhukant, her husband, who will soon rise to drive to his job at MGM, where he now works in the parking office rather than parking the cars himself. Mithun, who will take two trains to his engineering classes at Cal State University's Los Angeles branch. And Pranil, who will ride with his father to eighth grade at one of the city's failing public schools with a student-teacher ratio of 40 to 1, and where he has already had several rounds of gang prevention education. Across town, her eldest son, Vinay, is also rising to take the first shift at the motel he manages with his new bride. Mala spares them a thought as she puts away last night's clean dishes and packs her husband's lunch. If nothing is left over, she cooks a quick vegetable curry for him and gets a head start on tonight's meal. The tea boils. She strains it into a pot, gulps down her own cup, and hurries into the shower. There was a time when she would have climbed a stepladder every other day to scrub away the spatter of stains on the ceiling, but now the mildew has won the battle, enduring her curses but little physical challenge. Scrubbed clean, she pulls on her daily uniform, a grayish polyester shirt, long black skirt, multicolored tie, and matching polyester vest. This last item she calls, in Fijian Hindi English patois, a koti, and she hates it for being scratchy, unflattering, and most of all, hot. By the time she's dressed, the household is awake. She will leave the breakfast dishes to her sons, who, after long years of coaxing and haranguing, have been trained to do certain chores. At 6:20 a.m., Mala grabs her heavy black imitation leather purse and strides out the door, down one long block, through double glass doors, to clock in at 6:27 or so. She has graduated from her two restaurant jobs and works now in the hospital cafeteria. At $9.30 an hour, with health benefits, it is a definite step up. She assembles and delivers food, mostly to patients in the obstetrics ward who are about to have babies. She tries to pause once a day to walk casually over to a patient's window and, chatting all the while, look out toward her own home. From certain rooms in the hospital, on certain floors, she can see the back corner of the La Mirada apartments. In the middle of the day, it feels good to get a glimpse of the shelter she has worked so hard to provide for her family and for herself.
Great. I think we have time for some questions. I'll just point at you. Yeah, they're coming with the microphone.
I'm interested in your cousins spread across five continents. Are you able to quantify who's leading a better life? Is there anyone you really feel, oh gosh, I wish I'd ended up there, or anyone you think, thank God, that didn't happen to me?
No, you know, it's hard for me to quantify like that. I think that most of my relatives feel that wherever they ended up is certainly superior to all of the other places. The one thing that I can say is that in my family, the people who are left in India are the poorest people in the family. And that is because we came from a village that was suffering economically, and so the people who could afford to get out left and were able to make better livings, generally speaking, in the diaspora, and the people who weren't able to leave didn't do so well. But I think that is also sort of particular to my family. I wouldn't generalize that to most diasporans, because there are a lot of people who are here who actually maybe their families in India are better off too. I think economically it's hard to say. There are certainly places where life is really tough. There's one branch of my mother's family that was in Kenya in the 50s and 60s and then had to flee Kenya and live as refugees for a period of time before they were able to settle in England, because there was a strong African nationalist government that came into power and that basically made it very difficult for Indians to stay in Kenya. Certainly one thinks, oh, how lucky that I didn't have to go through that kind of thing. But generally, I think that people in my family have been able to make homes for themselves in different places in different ways. And it's just quite different in terms of what the culture is, but it's not necessarily better or worse. You know, my cousins who are growing up in Hong Kong are growing up speaking Cantonese, and so they're having a completely different experience than I had, but hard to say better or worse.
Hi, I just started reading your book yesterday, and I'm really, really enjoying your voices. I wonder, has anybody from India read the book, and do they read your voice and say, oh, she just sounds so American to me?
Oh, that's a good question. You mean in terms of my vocal quality?
Actually, the way you tell stories, all of
them. Oh. Well, definitely I have a strong American accent, I'm told, in any language I speak. So there's that. The book is being released in November in India, so I'll find out more about that then. At this point, the people who are from India originally who have read it or read pieces of it are still immigrants to this country, so they may be used to some more Americanness. I think that, I'm sure there are ways that I am American in my thinking that are hard for me to see myself, that other people could tell me better about.
Any other questions? Oh, way in the back.
Hello. I was wondering if any of your relatives got angry with you for telling some of the stories that other relatives had given you permission to tell, because sometimes when there's people with a common history and a common feeling of ownership over that same history, some may be willing to share some stories and others could become angry they shared those stories, and they might come to you and basically say, don't embarrass the family, why are you sharing those stories?
Yes. Yes, definitely. my sort of take on that is that I got to write the book, and everybody gets to have their own version of the story. And I tried in the writing to put together, to be fair and to collect many different versions of stories. And there were certainly, this is a little bit different from what you were asking about, but there were certainly cases where people just disagreed about how they remembered what happened or what happened. And so when that was the case, I tried to put either not tell that incident if it wasn't an important thing, or if I needed to talk about it, to just put down all the versions, you know, because I think that one of the things that does happen, particularly in diaspora, but maybe to all of us, is that this the sort of authoritative or the central version of the story is sort of lost. It's dispersed, and everybody has their own version. And then when they're trying to remember it 30 years later, they're going to remember things in different ways. And so, so I tried to just sort of give different versions of the stories. And there, I think, you know, again, the book is fairly recently out, so most of my relatives haven't gotten to read it yet, and I'll be interested to hear what that reaction is, and I expect that there will be more of that ahead. And then at the same time, generally, my family members have been very excited and very positive, and there have been flurries of emails sent all around the world, and people are waiting to read it. So I think that there's also a way that I'm hopeful that when people see the whole story in all of its context, that those concerns about revealing some part will sort of be mitigated somewhat.
Oh, sorry, there's a question. I knew that would happen at some point. Question right there.
Thank you. I really enjoyed and can relate a lot to what you've been talking about, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. And my question is, I'm about to embark on a similar project, interviewing my family for a master's thesis, and I'm wondering if you have any hot tips.
Yes, get your permission release form signed at the time that you interview them, not at the time that you're writing. And I guess the other thing that I would say is, even if you are fairly focused in what you're trying to study, stay open about how you ask questions, because you just never know what's going to come up from sort of a sideways question, and that can be some of the most revealing material. And I guess the thing that I was constantly surprised by is that, you know, I would do sort of all my reporter preparation and have my list of questions and think about what I really wanted to know from this person. And really what I found over and over is that people, if you're paying attention, people tell you who they are in like the first 20 minutes. You know, all you have to do is just notice. And people are very clear. Like, I think all of us in some way maybe are like that, unless we have a lot of masks and shields up, which even that is interesting information. But I don't know, there's a way that, like, the more you start to notice people and talk to people, the more you actually see who they are right away. Yeah.
Any other questions?
You use the word diaspora, and I'm just wondering if the Indian diaspora is different than what would be a Chinese diaspora, the Jewish diaspora.
Yeah.
And how did you choose that, Isabella? Define it, I guess.
So diaspora comes from the Greek, right? Diaspora. And it has this meaning of a scattering of people. And originally the word was applied almost exclusively, actually, to the Jewish diaspora. And then in the last maybe 40 years or so, the heathen have gotten their own diasporas. it's interesting because there's so much migration that's happening, and there is a distinction between migration and diaspora. And I think that what diasporas tend to have in common is that they have at their center either a real or an imaginary homeland, and the centrality of that homeland is important. And so I think, for example, that there's a movement now by African-American scholars to talk not just about African-American identity, but African diaspora identity, and to look at Africa as a resource and as a place that can inform what is happening or what could happen with African Americans and Africans elsewhere in the world, and a way, I think, to kind of emphasize that although we might have this American context where we're African Americans or South Asian Americans or Chinese Americans or Mexican Americans, that we also have another context that is about Indians all over the world and Mexicans all over the world, and that that context is equally important, and that we don't get sort of subsumed into this, since we're here, let's say, American narrative or American dream narrative, for example, but that we look at it in terms of what's happening, what happened and what is happening with people from India going other places in the world, that it creates this broader context, in a sense, that doesn't limit us to the country where we landed.
Is there a longing to go home?
I think that there is a longing to go home for some people, and for other people, there is an aversion to going home. There's a memory of trauma. For example, one of the things that helped to push a lot of people into diaspora was when India and Pakistan were created as independent nations, there was a partition and there was a lot of violence and trauma at that border. And so the communities of people who left at that moment, experienced these horrific events in their homeland. And so some folks respond to that with a nostalgia for the time before. Other folks respond to that with, what a crazy place, what a crazy country, never in a million years would I go back. So I think there's a lot of diversity about how that longing plays out. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more. Maybe, gentlemen, sorry.
Hi, like you, I come from various backgrounds, part Palestinian, part Eritrean, grew up in Ethiopia, emigrated to Iowa, and now I call L.A. home.
I lived in Iowa.
It's a great place, isn't it? What's your sense of home? What does home mean to you?
I think that home is a really complicated word. You know, when I've been on the road a lot lately, and so right now it feels like home is my cat and my bed and my little kitchen where I get to cook my own food. But I also know that that physical space would not be home except for the fact that I have my chosen family and my family of origin also in my life, and that that helps me to make a home. I think that it's sort of an endlessly interesting word, you know, and I suppose that there are people in the world for whom it's a pretty uncomplicated concept. But I think maybe for you and for me and people like us, it's just always a little bit of a puzzle.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.